I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Since 2011, the Kansas 3rd Congressional District has been a Republican bulwark. This year, though, Democrats smell an opportunity. Today, the district's sitting Congressman Kevin Yoder joins me to discuss the most recent revelations about the Trump administration, his reelection campaign, and his work in Washington. Then, a certain editorial published last week by the New York Times has thrust the use of anonymous sources into the spotlight. We'll ask the media critics if it's journalistically okay to use them and why. They'll also explain how off the record and on background really work. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. How close is the race between four-term incumbent Congressman Kevin Yoder and Democratic upstart Charisse Davids? Pretty darn close. The nonpartisan Cook Political Report rates the showdown as a toss-up. One big issue, immigration. Yoder has backed away from a Democratic plan to make it easier for migrants fleeing domestic abuse to claim asylum in this country. Another big issue, health care and the future of the Affordable Care Act. Congressman Kevin Yoder joins me here in the studio, and Congressman, it's always good to have you. Welcome back.
Steve, great to be back in studio. Thanks for having me on the show.
Now, this is looking to me to be your toughest race for Congress yet. Does it feel that way to you?
Well, I think anytime when you're in a midterm election and you're the party in power and you have the presidency, the House and the Senate, it's going to be difficult on the incumbent if they're in that party. And so, you know, each race we take very seriously, Steve. You know, this is my fifth time running for Congress. We ran in an open race in 2010. I think I had 8 Republican primary opponents. That was a pretty tough race.
Yes, it was.
We had then ran against the incumbent spouse. That was, you know, also a very serious race. And we had a lot of debates, and that was tough as well. And we've had some easier ones, some tougher ones. We expect this will be a challenging election season. But we're very pleased with where we are, working very hard. I will tell you, Steve, no one outworks me in a political race. We get adrenaline from it. We enjoy it. It's like Bob Dole's old thing where he could sit and talk to people all day long. He still does it. He came back a couple of years ago because he gets energy from it.
Yeah.
And so we work very hard. I go to, you know.
That means you're an extrovert, Congressman.
Yeah, well.
That's a classic textbook definition, I think.
I get enthused by it. The crowds energize me. So we like it. That doesn't make necessarily mean it's easy. I mean, but we get adrenaline from it. I would tell you, we work every corner of the district. You know, this is a very diverse district when you have Wyandotte County, Johnson County, and Miami County, and each neighborhood sort of has different perspectives. We've got very liberal neighborhoods, very conservative, very moderate. And in some ways, Steve, it's a cross-section of America, because if we can agree on things here in our community, then we're probably showing the rest of the country the way.
You know, we'll get to some of the issues in just a few minutes, but let's begin with President Trump, who's been the subject of so much attention lately. The big new book out by Bob Woodward, it's out today, and the controversial and anonymous op-ed last week in the New York Times. The message from both is similar, and that is the president can't be fully trusted to run the country. And my question is, do you have full trust in President Trump to run this country right now?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think he was democratically elected by the American people. He is the president of the United States, and we need to support him and work with him to get things done. And you contrast that by the folks on the far left who focus on resistance and obstruction, and we're focused on working with the president to solve problems.
But these are insiders, presumably from your party, who are saying this president may be unfit to hold the office.
Look, I don't get involved in the palace intrigue that drives the cable news talk shows and that drives the book sales.
This is fairly serious.
Yeah, look,
this is
look,
Bob Woodward with a new book who's got a sterling reputation.
I take all of those things seriously, and I think we should all be rooting for folks to work with the president. I think it's concerning if folks are saying their goal is to undermine the president, that they're quietly resisting from within. I know people would say they would be very concerned if there was a Tea Party person in the Obama administration that was saying they're quietly trying to undermine the president. That would be outrage. And so I think we've become very divided as a country. Everything has become, high stakes endeavor.
Right.
So everything is for playing for keeps here. My goal, Steve, is whether it's President Obama or would have been President Clinton or President Trump, is to work with them to get things done on behalf of the American people. And I work with President Obama on a lot of things. I've worked with the current president, and I've opposed the president on many things because we have to put what's right for the 3rd District and for the American people first.
Congressman, the president himself calls this act, this anonymous op-ed, treason. Single word tweet out last week. Is it treason in your view?
I don't know if I would call it treason. I think it depends what job this person has, right? If this person has a job that deals with national security or something that might affect our safety and security of the American people, maybe. I think it depends where they are, if they're a mid-level bureaucrat. So we don't know enough about who they are or what they do, but I just think there's too much of an effort to obstruct this administration at every turn. I understand many people don't like what this administration stands for. I don't like the president's tweets many, many times. I don't like the style. But I do think when the president focuses on the economy, when he focuses on national security, he does have the support of the majority of the American people. I mean, look at where we are economically right now, Steve. And people will say, look, I talk to people all the time, will say, Kevin, I like what you're doing. I like where the economy is. I have concerns about the president, or I don't. People might say they don't like the president. And so he is a factor in every conversation. I completely get that.
A lot of people would say, with some justification, he's our national provocateur, that he's getting as good as he's giving here and maybe provoking the country to be in this intensely divided state that maybe is more intense than it was even a few years ago.
Yeah, and if that's the case, I don't like that part of it. I do think there's a codependency here between the media and the presidency. They feed off each other. And look, that's not why I got into public service. That's not why I got into politics. My goal is to fight for the people of my community and solve problems. And so that's the tact I took, whether it was President Obama or whether it's going to be President Trump. And I will tell you, we get calls all the time from people saying they want us to impeach the president. I mean, that those calls come into our office. And it was very interesting, Steve. The first 6 years that I served in this seat, President Obama was a president. We got calls every day, roughly, from people saying, need to impeach President Obama. Now we get calls every day saying you need to impeach President Trump. What I try to do is tune all of that out and focus on what are the words I'm using? What are the statements I'm making? What do my tweets say? How am I representing the principles, the values, the things that our community wants me to stand for? And that's the job that I'm set to do, and that's what I focus on and don't get caught up in these other issues.
Let me read you one paragraph from the anonymous op-ed in the Times last week, and I'm quoting here. The dilemma, which the president does not fully grasp, is that many of the senior officials in his own administration are working diligently from within to frustrate parts of his agenda and his worst inclinations. In a sense, I'm paraphrasing now, the administration is working against itself. Does that suggest that Congress needs to up its game when it comes to oversight of this administration?
Well, I have long argued, whether it was the last administration or this administration, that Congress should be more engaged in the oversight of the administration, that the executive branch has too much power, and that the laws ought to be enforced as written by Congress. And presidents tend to ignore that. And so, we want a country that's focused on solving problems of the American people. That's where I am. That's where the country needs to go. And there's a battle between those who, for all lack of a word, hate the president and the president, attacking other folks. I just think all that's unproductive. I've mentioned this to the administration. I've stood up when the president has said things that I've disagreed with, whether it was in Charlottesville or, his tweet about John Lewis, So I try to lead by example here. And, I've been in your program many times with Emanuel Cleaver.
Right.
He and I co-chair a caucus called the Civility Caucus.
Right.
And our goal is to bring civility back to politics, to get people talking to each other, listening to each other. And that's not happening enough in this country.
Congressman, I get that. I want to just try one more time on this administration, because some of this, some of the anonymous op-ed, the Woodward book, are really sort of unprecedented, at least in my experience covering politics. We're at a moment here. And I'm wondering, how concerned are you about the president when these kinds of things, with some justification and verification, are being written about him?
Well, again, I think if people are actively working to undermine the president of the United States, who was elected by the American people, and are proud of that fact, and we're heralding that fact, we've gotten to a really bad spot. And so,
or undermining him, or is the president, again, is he capable of doing the job before him?
Yes.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. Let's turn to your race against Democrat Charisse Davids, and I want to play you an ad that your campaign is running right now against Charisse Davids. Okay, we don't have it right now, but this ad concludes with three words, dishonest, dangerous, and then the words, and too radical. Mm-hmm. Is she really?
Yeah, I mean, Charisse Davids is the most radical liberal candidate that's ever been nominated for Congress in the 3rd District and possibly
the
most
history. Radical ever.
Yes, yes.
Why?
Well, we have a history in this district, Steve, particularly on the Democratic side. They've always tried to nominate a blue dog in the mold of Dennis Moore. And now I have an opponent who says in the paper, she says I'm not a moderate. She says that Nancy Pelosi is a tremendous leader. She had said in repeated interviews that she supported either was coy about it or didn't answer the way she's trying to answer now, that she supported abolishing ICE. Mm-hmm. She supports.
She said she doesn't want
to
abolish ICE.
She says that now. But, you know, Steve, even when the Kansas City Star asked her about it the day after the election, they sent her a questionnaire and she wrote out answers. I don't even believe it was live. And one of the questions was, do you support abolishing ICE? She didn't say yes. She didn't say no. She said the movement to abolish ICE stems from a real concern amongst actions that they're taking. So she tried to play coy on it or say she supported abolishing ICE, right? I mean, if anyone wants to listen to the Millennial Project audio, I encourage you listen to the entire thing. They ask her if she wants to abolish it, to be clear, and she says, well, I do, but I would support defunding it, which is the same thing. And only when we started calling her on that, Steve, did she decide to change her answer on that, which is fine. But the point is—
But why call her dangerous, though?
Well, because I think abolishing ICE is very dangerous. When you look at, they had 32,000 criminal arrests last year. The Homeland Security Investigations Team, HSI, they're responsible for investigating drug trafficking and sex trafficking, all these horrible crimes. They arrested over 4,000 drug traffickers and gang members. And so these are folks that make our country less safe. And the idea that we would abolish that, we would defund that, means that our families and our community is less safe. That is dangerous. That is dangerous. And Steve, I don't think the people of this district agree with that, which is why she's trying to change her position on it after holding that same position for so long. That is a very dangerous, very radical position to take. And I think it speaks to a larger left-wing movement within the Democratic Party. This is not a moment in which the Democrats are saying, let's nominate centrist candidates in the mold of Dennis Moore. Let's nominate blue dogs. They're not saying that. You know, Dennis Moore ran as a centrist. My opponent's saying she's running as a liberal, running as a progressive. You know, she says she's not a moderate. That's new, and we don't have a record of electing left-wing extremists here. And I, you know, certainly I've had moderate people say they don't like the gubernatorial nominee, right? But for the same reason that you shouldn't like the Democratic nominee for Congress, because you have folks that many will argue are on the opposite ends of the spectrum. So I will tell you, Steve, in the fall election, I will be the centrist in this race.
Well, speaking of the gubernatorial nominee, do you support Kris Kobach for governor?
I support the entire ticket, Steve.
Okay.
Yep.
Let me turn to immigration again. Kansas Congressman Kevin Yoder is my guest. Democrats are saying you're the one who's been dangerous here because twice in recent months you've switched positions on key aspects of the immigration debate. Just a few days ago, you said you no longer support a Democratic plan to make it easier for migrants fleeing domestic abuse or gang violence to claim asylum in this country. The Star reported that this came after no less a personage than the Attorney General of the United States called your office to complain about your backing of this Democratic plan. Why did you back away from it?
Well, Steve, we never did. And I think if you read the quotes that I gave to Brian Lowry on it, the headline didn't match the quotes, which is a big challenge at the Star, which I'm sure you're aware of. But, you know, what I explained to Brian and I've explained to multiple reporters throughout this situation is that I support people with domestic violence claims being able to make those claims in their asylum claim when they come as part of a thing that the government ought to be able to factor in.
But not automatic asylum.
Not automatic asylum if you just make the claim. I support it as being a part of a claim that you could make and that we shouldn't turn away somebody if that is their only part of a claim. We ought to consider that.
But did you or did you not back the Democratic plan?
Yeah, Steve, if you let me finish.
Okay.
So in committee, I said I supported that and I supported the proposal that was brought forward in committee.
The Democratic plan.
It was brought by Democrats. That's right,
okay.
Steve, because I work across the aisle to get things done. I also supported a Democratic plan that would make sure that DACA kids can't be deported. right? I also supported a Democratic plan that would ensure that we can't separate parents from their children.
But after you,
right?
after so you made this decision to support the plan, you received a call from Jeff Sessions.
Nope. I've never talked to Jeff Sessions
about it.
Okay,
your staff did.
They did beforehand.
Okay.
Not after.
Not
after. Beforehand.
Okay.
And we supported that. There have been concerns raised that allowing this would allow a lot of fraudulent claims. And in talking to the CBP, the Customs Border Protection at the border, there have been clear concerns that this would allow millions of people potentially to make fraudulent claims. And what I have said is,
in other words, I'm being abused back in my home country.
Don't have to prove much.
You don't have to prove anything.
Right. And then they get a court date 5 years later. And so that was not our intent. That was not my intent. So what I said is I was going to work to fix the amendment. And that's the quote that I released a couple days after the amendment passed. I actually said that in the Kansas City Star, ran an article saying Yoder flips on the issue. So you already wrote that back in July. And I said I would work to fix it. Then 6 weeks later, I talked to Brian Lowry, your Star reporter, and I mentioned when we were talking about other things I'm working on that it's going to be difficult to get that provision all the way through the process.
Right.
I'm the chairman of the committee. It's not in the Senate version. It's in the House version, but it's not supported by the administration, and that it's probably going to have to go back to committee to get more work. It's probably a Judiciary Committee issue. It's probably beyond what the Appropriations Committee is able to sort out, this issue of how you stop fraudulent claims. What we need, Steve, is more judges at the border. We need the ability to deal with claims promptly so that accurate claims get dealt with and false claims get dealt with as well, and people can return to their country if they have a false claim.
What kind of evidence do you need to prove that someone is being abused back in their home country? I mean, again, you can get into
so what happens right now when you quickly. What happens right now is when you walk into the country, you can make sort of a prima facie argument, and then you might get a court date 5 years later to come back to make the case. People don't show up. And then the judge goes ahead and then has a hearing on the evidence and the facts. And my understanding is 80% of those cases aren't actually ever proven, or the folks don't show up. And so what we want to avoid, though, is an opportunity for more human trafficking, more illegal immigration to come into the country. And Steve, that's where I focused my time in leadership on this committee. You know, the first thing I did when I got into this chairmanship about 3 or so months ago is I went down to the border and I personally looked at what we were dealing with in the Rio Grande Valley. We're being overrun. Drug trafficking, human trafficking, it puts our border communities at a risk. It puts our own communities at a risk. When you look at drug cartels made $64 billion last year in selling drugs in the United States, Steve, and now it's the largest cause of death for people under the age 50. I don't know about you, Steve, but that makes me mad that our government hasn't done its job to secure its borders, to protect the American people. And all that profit, it goes back down to Mexico. They had a 19% increase in murder rates this year. I'm told that 95 to 98% of the crimes in Mexico aren't even being prosecuted. And so a lot of that's being fueled, Steve, by the dollars of American people that are buying drugs that are coming across the border. And so that goes back to my opponent. When she doesn't want to secure the border, she doesn't want to enforce our immigration laws, that makes us less safe. That is dangerous. That is radical, and that is something that is not consistent with what the people of this district want to see done.
You still favor building the fence, the wall that the president
talked
about.
I listen to the Customs Border Protection folks, and I encourage everyone to talk to them. I encourage my opponent to listen to them. They want barriers in the Rio Grande Valley sector. They want barriers in the Laredo sector. What we did in my bill was give them resources to use on their top priorities with the types of materials they want. So they're talking about 18 steel bollards, and in some places it's vehicle barriers. You know, we have barriers on 650 out of 2,000 miles, right? I don't find many people, maybe my opponent, I don't find many people asking to take those down. Right, so most people agree that barriers work when they're combined with personnel and technology. And when you talk to the folks at the border, they tell you we need more personnel, we need more agents, we need more technology, and we need barriers to work together to secure our borders. And when we see folks trying to undermine that, fighting those barriers, fighting the new agents, right? They want to defund these agencies. That puts our communities, that puts the American people at risk. That is too radical and too dangerous. And it's something this district has never voted for before,
right?
Those left-wing ideas. And that's why I think my opponent is going to have a difficult time.
Representative Kevin Yoder is my guest. Staying with immigration, Congressman, in June you said that separating migrant children from the adults who brought them across the border illegally was necessary to keep them safe from traffickers and drug cartels. It was okay then to separate kids from their parents. That was your position. About 10 days later, you shifted course after hearing from constituents back home in your district. My question, when is it ever okay to separate kids from their parents?
Well, I don't think I ever said it was okay. I think the challenge was people were violating our laws and we couldn't put children in the adult jails that the Department of Justice was moving forward on. So we had a very tough choice to make, either release the adults, again, for 5-year court dates down the road, or keep them jailed together, which they couldn't do under a court settlement that doesn't allow them to do that. Or the administration was telling us they had no choice but to separate them. I had been chair of the committee for about 2 weeks. I worked to investigate it. I got a lot of credit, actually, Steve, for fixing this problem. You know, I met with the Secretary of Homeland Security. As a leader of the Committee on Homeland Security, I wrote a very stinging letter to the Attorney General to demand that they stop this, that it is too harsh of a penalty, that it is something that is too difficult for the families to endure. I have a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old, and it's something that, to me, was heartbreaking. And so I stepped in and did something about it the more I learned about it. And I will tell you, Steve, when we first started talking about that 3 weeks before then, no one knew the extent of the issue. You didn't, Steve. The media didn't. We were all learning about what was going on.
And you were reacting.
And I was asking the administration, what is going on here? And they were saying, look, because of the folks coming across violating our laws, this is the only option before this.
You know,
so when I learned about it, I stepped up and did something about it and actually fixed the problem. And I would say I've gotten a lot of credit. A lot of people have come up to me and said, look, I'm a moderate. I voted for Hillary Clinton or whatever, but I support you because of your leadership on that issue.
You know, one of your points for a while has been that a lot of folks back home here don't realize how much deception is going on at the border when it comes to adults with kids. They claim to be their own. They're not, in fact, their own kids. People saying, I've been abused back home, when they maybe haven't really been abused back home, all in an effort to get across the border legally. How big of a problem do we have in that realm?
Well, folks that are coming across the country, coming across the border, are being trafficked in. They're having to pay drug traffickers $7,000 or $8,000 a person. They are sometimes being sexually assaulted. They're being abused. And it's just a unsafe environment for the someone trying to migrate into the country. It's a profit for the cartels. Folks need to come to the ports of entry. If they have a lawful asylum claim, they need to come to the ports of entry and have that claim heard. We got to do it quicker. But using drug cartels to sneak across the border puts them at risk. It puts everybody at risk, and it makes more profit for these cartels that are creating all the lawlessness and violence.
We have a phone call from Mary from Peculiar, Missouri, on the Missouri side, I guess. Mary, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead, Mary.
Okay, I'm interested in Kevin Yoder because he's federal. I want to know if they're going to try and secure Canadian borders as well, because as many drugs, from what I'm reading, are coming through Canada borders as they are Mexican borders.
Does there need to be more focus on the Canadian border, Congressman?
Well, look, anywhere we see crime and drug trafficking, human trafficking, you know, we're stepping in to fill those gaps. The biggest issue that we have is the Rio Grande Valley sector. This is an area that comes from the Gulf of Mexico and goes west several hundred miles. That's where the majority of drug trafficking and the majority of human trafficking is occurring. That's our weak spot. And we have shown throughout the border, if we can add barriers, personnel, technology, we can put it there. We can actually solve that. But, to the extent that we have challenges at the northern border, we will focus on that as well.
Let's turn to health care in the few minutes we have left, Congressman. During the primary, Democrats hit you for voting for the GOP health care bill that could have cost as many as 81,000 of your constituents their health coverage. Why did you go there?
Well, our goal, Steve, is to preserve the American healthcare system. It's the greatest healthcare system in the world. It has the best innovation, access, quality of care. And Obamacare is not working the way that it was said to work. Premiums are still skyrocketing.
Well, arguably, your party hasn't helped a lot.
Well, I think our party could do a better job of it. But Obamacare itself needs to be fixed and improved. And we need to preserve the American healthcare system. And you contrast that, Steve, where the left is going now. My opponent supports a bill that abolishes private and employer-based insurance. That's very radical. Abolishing all private and employer-based insurance, that throws 178 million people, Steve, get their healthcare that way. It throws them off of their insurance.
Well,
and it makes them have to get their insurance through the government.
What's wrong with Medicare for All?
Well, that's not what it is, Steve, because Medicare for All, there are co-payments, there's Medicare Advantage. What my opponent supports is free health care for all, paid for with a $32 trillion tax increase, which has been estimated by even left-leaning associations to maybe almost triple our federal income taxes, leading to doctor shortages because you cut the rate down. You know, the Medicare rate's 40% less than the private pay rate, so you cut that down. Their bill makes private hospitals illegal, so it expects that they will reduce the amount of hospitals we have in this country. So you have less doctors, less hospitals, a tripling of our federal taxes, less access to care, and all of it's mandatory. It's you abolish, Steve. I walk the streets with me and see how many people believe that we ought to abolish all private and employer-based care and make it mandatory. And by the way, when you think about Medicare, Steve, seniors have spent their entire lives paying into this program. You're paying into it. I'm paying it now. Everyone who's working is paying into Medicare, and it's a specialized program for seniors. And what the folks like my opponent on the left want to do is they want to put everybody in that program, even people that haven't paid for it, even people that haven't paid a dime, maybe not even working. They want to give everyone free health care. It ruins the program for seniors. And they also want to hurt the veterans programs as well and wrap that into it. And so But it's a very dangerous proposal, Stephen. It's way outside the mainstream, and it's radical. And I encourage people to examine it's House Resolution 676, and what it would do to the American healthcare system would destroy it, triple our taxes, and take away 178 million people's private and employer-based care.
We're getting questions like this. Please ask Congressman Yoder if he knows how many of his constituents have pre-existing conditions and why he supports leaving them without health insurance. The GOP is suing to eliminate protections. The Senate bill doesn't guarantee coverage for pre-existing conditions.
I support guaranteeing coverage for people with pre-existing conditions.
No question. Okay. We're about out of time. I want to thank you for coming in and sharing your time with us here today as you go about your tough race against the Democrat. And that's Kansas Congressman Kevin Yoder from the state's 3rd District. Thanks so much for coming in, Congressman.
Thanks for having me back on the show.
Sorry we couldn't get to all our phone calls today. Coming up, when we come back, we'll visit with our media critics about that anonymous New York Times op-ed last week. Was that fair to run an anonymous piece like that? I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Tomorrow on the show, where we're headed in human technology interaction, a former military pilot turned engineering professor gives her view on the inevitability of automation in our lives. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, the New York Times just rocked the world of journalism by publishing an anonymous op-ed from a senior Trump administration official that she or he said and others in the White House were attempting to shield the president from his worst impulses. The op-ed has turned out to be big news, not just for its content, but also for the Times' decision to publish an anonymous piece. How fair is that to print the beefs of an official who's not willing to put his or her name next to what's being written? Then again, if the official is convinced that he is saving the nation from Trump, does that justify the move? Now, a visit with our media critics who are here to sort out all of this and to explain what off the record really means. Peggy Lowe is the investigations editor for Harvest Public Media based here at KCUR. Peggy, welcome.
Good morning, Steve.
Melinda Henneberger is a colleague of mine on the Kansas City Star editorial board. She's also written for the New York Times and the Washington Post. Melinda, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you.
Before we get into the specifics of this piece, Melinda, explain what the difference between an opinion piece and an editorial is, because they're pretty similar, right?
I would say that an editorial is a kind of opinion piece, but it's different from a column, which is your personal view, versus an editorial that you're writing on the behalf of the entire editorial board.
It's a piece that takes the collective wisdom of the board and puts it forward. Peggy, you've
worked... With an emphasis on wisdom.
Yes, let's hope so. Peggy, you've worked at newspapers. When a newspaper publishes an editorial on a pressing issue, does that mean that the ensuing coverage then by the reporters at that paper will have to support that editorial stance?
Absolutely not. I mean, there's always
been
a firewall.
People think that, though.
They really think that. So in every newspaper I've worked at, there is a firewall between the newsroom and the op-ed page. And I don't talk to them about what they're going to, you know, write about, and they don't talk to me about it.
You know, Melinda, the news gathering side of a newspaper and the editorial board, just to piggyback on what Peggy just said, how separate are they based on your experience?
Very separate. I mean, we follow with interest, and that's about it.
You know, should newspapers these days even be in the business of publishing editorials? I mean, if readers think that editorials bias the coverage by a newspaper staff, you know, what's the point?
I think the point is really well stated in what happened when the New York Times published this op-ed last week. I think that this showed such a different side of the Trump administration that we knew. I mean, we knew a little bit about the chaos and how there were some folks who were very worried about the president's stability. But when you have an op-ed person, an op-ed published in the Times, written by someone within the Trump administration, saying, quote, "the root of the problem is the president's amorality," that's news, that's insight, and that is critical to what's going on today.
Melinda, you still think there's a case for editorials even in the fake news era when a lot of people don't really quite understand the difference between news gathering and editorials?
I think that we could do a better job of helping people understand the difference. And I think it's trickier online. That's more complicated because people just see things coming in over social media and they're not as well marked as they used to be if you only saw them in the physical newspaper.
That's a great point.
But sure, I think that we have, I mean, people do look to us to see what we're saying. We know that because they're so often angry about it.
Yeah. Well, what about editorial supporting one candidate or issue over another? Is it a paper's place to attempt to sway the public, Peggy?
I know that's always been a huge role of newspapers in the past, that the op-ed board would endorse either or candidates.
It's a tradition that goes back decades, right?
Absolutely. And then that's typically becomes news. It's reported upon that, oh, the Times or the Star endorsed this candidate or that candidate. I think that it was always important. I now think, however, given the current climate, that a lot of folks don't care about that anymore, quite frankly.
Melinda, do you think folks care what the Star, where we come down on endorsing one candidate or another?
I certainly understand the argument that they don't, as Peggy says. But when you see, again, how happy or unhappy they can be, I guess I would say that convinced me that some people still care very much.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to the New York Times last week that published this op-ed by this senior administration official. The writer of the op-ed remained anonymous. Let me just ask the two of you, would you have published it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, Melinda, how about you?
I hope I would not have. I understand the pressure to do so, but it made me very uncomfortable that I'm hoping still that it really is someone we think of as a senior administration official, because given sourcing guidelines, that could be absolutely anybody. If it's somebody we've never heard of, that's going to just fuel the whole fake news. Who was this really? I think that that person should have come forward. I think that was a very difficult call for the editorial editors at the New York Times.
Wouldn't you have loved to have been a fly on the wall in that conversation? Because I had real issues with it, too, just the anonymity of it.
The anonymity of an attack, that's my basic problem with it, is not only for what it, you know, the non-favor it may end up doing the rest of us in this business, but anonymity is not supposed to be used to cloak an attack. I mean, it's even a rule in journalism that you don't quote someone anonymously who's just talking trash about someone they have it in for. That's not an appropriate use of that. And I certainly did not agree with the president when he called it treason, but he did have a point that it came across to me as unfair.
I'm going to get Peggy's view on this, and I want to ask our listeners to chime in here on what they have published this piece or not. 816-235-2888 is our phone number. Again, 816-235-2888. You can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Peggy Lowe, you have the floor here. You would have published why?
I would have published it because it does offer, as I said earlier, some insight into the Trump administration and confirms what had been reported before. I don't think when I first read it, and I was shocked, as everyone was when it was first published, my first reaction was, I think the writer didn't pose it as an attack, as you suggested. And I think that they posed it sort of like, okay, you guys, it's cool. We got it. You know, we're watching this guy. We're taking the letters off the desk, that kind of thing. That said, it wasn't read that way, certainly by virtually anybody.
Right.
A lot of folks have called it gutless. A lot of folks have even said, you know, is there a shadow government that we didn't elect?
But the takeaway here was unmistakable. It was a devastating portrait of the commander in chief.
Absolutely, especially the same week that Bob Woodward's book came out.
And it is news. There is news in there, and I'm certainly not saying that that news should not have been reported, that there are people within the administration who feel like that. That should have been a story. But to give that person a platform on the editorial page is a different thing.
You know, the Times has written a piece sort of explaining why it did what it did. Does the Times know who this official is? What do we know about that?
Well, from what I read about it, it seemed that they were making me even more worried that it was someone we have never heard of when they said this person was introduced to us by a trusted third party. Mm-hmm. If that person is being introduced to the New York Times editorial board, that means that's not a that said to me, at least, unless I read that wrong or there's some other meaning there, that's not someone who's been a source of the New York Times. Mm-hmm. That's not someone who they were familiar with, which made deepened my worries that it's not a household name.
You know, my assumption here, and again, I want to underline the word assumption, is that in order for the Times to have printed this thing, that this anonymous source almost should have been or has to be someone who's orbiting around the West Wing on a daily basis. This isn't a cabinet official who flits in and out of here once or twice a month. This is someone who's there observing the daily operations of this White House, or maybe it would raise even more questions in my mind.
Right. I don't know that it's a cabinet official either. I would agree with you on that point. That said, a lot of Washington observers have said, when you say senior White House official, that could be hundreds of people.
It could be anyone, yeah. Honestly.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
that's what that means in Washingtonese,
right.
When I was there for so many years.
Yeah.
And I also hope the New York Times is very certain about this person's motivation, that what you see is what you get, and that there wasn't something else at work here.
The Times sort of said you can never really tell what someone's motivation is, but acknowledge that was a question that was in their minds,
right.
Too, you know.
Well, they did make this decision in only 2 days, which is quick.
Yeah. 816-235-2888 is our number. Would you have published that anonymous New York Times piece that ran last week or not? Let's go to some calls. Chris from Stillwell on the Kansas side. Good morning.
Hi, Steve. No, I wouldn't have published it. And I think that the New York Times did itself a grave disservice. If it's going to be a reliable source of information or an opinion maker that's going to influence people, it has to retain its objectivity. And when you do an anonymous piece like this, there's no ability to judge the objectivity or the reliability of the source. If this person was really courageous, he or she should have come forth, said, this is what's going on. And the timing of it related to the release of Woodward's book also, it makes it sound like a fantasy piece that a New York Times editorial writer who hates the Trump administration just created. I don't think that's what happened. But for skeptical people, I'm afraid that that's the kind of damage that
right.
It's done.
Yeah, you know, Chris, I appreciate the call. You know, you can make a case, as Chris just pointed out, that this writer, the honorable thing would have been to resign and
right.
walk away.
Right.
But what if it's true, assuming for a moment, that these people within the administration are, in fact, protecting the American people from this president's worst instincts? Is it possible this writer could then make a case that I'm going to stick around and remain anonymous because of the great service I'm doing to all humankind by sticking around?
Well, we've thought for a long time that there were so-called adults in the room, and I think that phrase is in this piece.
It is. Yeah.
That who were there not to protect Donald Trump, but to protect democracy. And that's great. But when it goes so far as to be stealing documents off the president's desk and trying to fool him and hoping he forgets not to look again for the thing he was going to sign, then you have, I think, a duty to come forward, announce yourself and say, this is what's happening in the White House.
Right. David Frum of The Atlantic said, speak in your own name, resign in a way that will count. I think that's what your caller feels.
Yeah. Back to some calls here. Let's go to Paul from Lenexa. Paul, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. I want to interject something a little different here. I mean, I'm probably called liberal, but I read the Wall Street Journal every day and specifically make sure that I don't read editorials. And actually, based on that, I would say that the Wall Street Journal does not have a leaning, either right or left, if you just read the news. And I do have an advantage being retired and having the time to do it. But needing editorial and actually using that to bias the news, I don't find helpful at all.
Okay. Paul, thanks for the call. I appreciate it.
Surely.
Rudolph from Raytown. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. My comment is this. In these situations, it seems as if everybody is focused on the who rather than on the content. And even the administration now is on a manhunt for this person. And I just feel like all of us, even the president and even his top officials, need to be focused on the content. Is this content true to some extent or not? And don't worry about the who so much. Because if the content is true, then we have bigger problems than just one person submitting a piece to the New York Times. And I'll take your comments off the air.
Okay. If it is true, Peggy, what should happen here?
I would agree with Rudolph that I'm already sick of this whodunit. It's like a parlor game now. It's a political parlor game, and I'm really tired of that. I would also suggest that what Rudolph just said, it should be taken into account. Let's be more concerned with what this guy said or this woman said. I dug this up from Bob Woodward in Writer's Digest in 1996. Quote, "The benefit of good sources who don't want to be identified is that they might tell you the truth." So presumably this guy's telling us the truth, and this is something we should know.
Okay. I think we have another call here who I think is on the Peggy Lowe side of this argument. Chris from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Hi. Good hour. Two things. One, his resignation, we know for a fact, would make no difference because we have a long, long, long list of resignations that have made absolutely no difference. That's the first thing. Secondly, this man who's doing this resistance, it may be needed, but I would have never published this letter. Because he can't stand against the power that Trump hides behind. I'm a classic Republican. I'm not a Trumpster. And you can't hide behind, you can't take on the power of the presidency. So this is the only way that resistance can work. I wouldn't have published it for that very reason. But again, you can't go straight forward, one. And two, it would make no difference if he came out. It's not an act of courage. All these other people did it, and not an iota of one thing changed. So.
Melinda?
But they didn't, I guess I would differ a little in that they didn't say they were quitting because of something like this. I mean, there have been a long line of people who have quit or been pushed out over various corruption scandals and on, but I can't think of anyone who has quit in the way a couple of Clinton administration people did, saying, I can no longer work for this administration and here's why.
One tweet we just received makes this observation. I think it needs to be discussed. Sometimes the only way to get the truth is through anonymity. What you were saying, Peggy, remember Deep Throat. Is this comparable to Deep Throat? Is this the same kind of thing?
Well, you know, Bob Woodward, who knows about Deep Throat, says that that the current situation dwarfs anything that happened during Watergate. So, I mean, I take Bob Woodward's book very seriously.
Yeah.
And I'm certainly not arguing that we should never use anonymous sources. All of this is highly ironic because one of the greatest anonymous sources of all times, back from my days in the no longer existing New York Newsday, was one Donald J. Trump. He used to call the newsroom constantly when he was getting a divorce, trying to plant tidbits about the models and actresses who were supposedly after him. So, I mean, for him to be complaining about anonymous sources is rich.
It is something. Sally from Lawrence, you're on Up to Date, Sally.
Hey, I just wanted to make the comment that had he not been anonymous, then upon hearing this information, he would have been disclosed and had to resign. When he was anonymous, we got reactions from the Republicans, including Senator Rubio, who confirmed that they personally would not do anything knowing this information. Therefore, the person who remained anonymous can feel relieved that it was the appropriate thing for him to do in order to stay in the position he's in that's protecting us all.
Okay. Sally, thank you. Will the New York Times ever reveal who this person is?
The op-ed pages said that they won't, I think. I will say that I really like what the op-ed page did as far as transparency goes, in that they published like a Q&A that said, here's how this came about. And that's a really good read to answer a lot of your questions about that. So I would certainly suggest reading that. No, they're saying that they will protect him. But as Margaret Sullivan in The Washington Post pointed out, won't it be ironic if the New York Times news side, you know, reports who this is while the op-ed page has to keep it a secret?
So. It won't remain hidden. Nothing ever does. The question is when. Yeah. This person will be outed.
Mm-hmm. Well, on a related topic, let's turn to the use of off-the-record information, one of those journalistic terms that sometimes confuses people. Why would any source, Melinda, be off the record with a reporter?
Any number of reasons, some of them appropriate and some of them not. But when someone comes to you off the record, they're giving you the information. They're not giving you permission to go with it attached to their name. They're telling you that you can find this by other means through other sources. It's strictly, this is for you to know and for you to get confirmed elsewhere.
Who can request off the record? I mean, can anyone who's a source request being off the record, Peggy?
Yes, anyone can. If that's the deal they make with the reporter and or the station or paper, I'm assuming yes, everyone can ask.
It's gotten
that, right?
So crazy, though, now I think people have really taken it too far, that I can be asked, can I say this off the record? And then it's something that's exactly the same as they say on the record.
Yes.
It's really.
Right. Hey, how do you establish that when you're talking to a source, Peggy, and the source says, I'm interested in talking to you off the record? How do you proceed from that point? What's the negotiation that takes place?
It's a really difficult dance, that negotiation. And for instance, I'm just going through this today. I have been trying to deal with this business source who is very nervous about this story coming out. So he wanted to have an off-the-record conversation on the phone first, then with the promise of he would follow up with an email with his stuff that'll be on the record. So we agreed to that, but the story comes out and he's still angry about certain things that were in and out. People are super touchy and people aren't as brave as they used to be, maybe.
I think that's true.
My experience, Melinda, is reporters need to be really upfront with sources in terms of, so that everyone understands what
yes.
off the record means
yes.
and what on the record is. And
as opposed to on background,
yeah.
which is different because that means you can use this, but not with my name.
What about if someone says, I want it off the record retroactively? They've already spoken to you,
uh-uh.
and they call you back an hour later and say, Melinda, that was off the record.
It depends who you are, frankly. If you've never dealt with a reporter before in your life, then I may, and you are somebody who's been drawn into something you never expected, then I might be a lot more lenient in bending that rule than if you're an official who's been dealing with reporters your entire career. And I've had that happen too, where someone tries to say, take something off the record retroactively. In that case, it's a hard no.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to have to leave our good conversation there. I want to thank Melinda Henneberger from the editorial board of the Kansas City Star, Peggy Lowe, investigations editor for Harvest Public Media, based here at KCUR. Peggy, always good to have you.
Thanks, Steve.
Tomorrow on the show, what role will humans play in a world dominated by technology and artificial intelligence? We'll find out. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Kathleen Pointer. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.